Everybody, I'd like to call the House Fisheries Committee to order on March 17th, 2009 at approximately 10:15. At the moment, we have three of the seven committee members here, but since we're doing basically a work session, if you will, today, hearing an overview without having any bills in front of us, we can proceed without having a quorum. To my right is Representative Book and Vice Chair Keller, and I expect that once we have a press conference done on the second floor, that we'll be joined by our other members. As we usually mention, we would ask everybody to keep their cell phones off, and please put them aside, if you will. This morning, we are going to have a very excellent presentation and feature a number of speakers, including Arnie Fugelvog, who works with Senator Murkowski back east and specializes in fisheries and Arctic issues. We have the privilege of having Rear Admiral Arthur Brooks here. Mr. Brooks, thank you for taking time to be with us today. And Dave Benton, who we haven't seen in the building much the last couple of years. Mr. Benton, thank you for being here as well. And we want to thank certainly the Unalaska delegation, particularly City Manager Chris Laddick, for bringing this idea forward, helping my staff and my office develop the agenda. And as such, I'd like to also recognize Mayor Shirley Marquardt, who's in the audience, along with Council Members McGlashan, Skip Southworth, and Dick Peck in the back there. And just before we begin, you know, obviously the issue about the Northwest Passage is more future-oriented than it is present tense, but it's happening at a quite rapid pace in terms of the various policy issues that surround the eventual opening up of the passageway. And that, I guess, brings us to the purpose of today's meeting, is to hear sort of a well-rounded perspective on what this would mean in terms of a coastal community's perspective, the Coast Guard, certainly a policy issue from the federal perspective, and also with Mr. Benton here, what the fisheries aspect of it all might look like in the future. So Mr. Laddick, if you want to come to the table and begin the presentation, we'd really appreciate that.
Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to come before you today and talk about the Arctic and the issues regarding, you know, the Bering Sea as part of the Arctic and what's happening now with increased human activity and what we're seeing with drilling in the Arctic, et cetera. It all goes through on Alaska. But my goal, I guess, is in the coming years that the state put some planning dollars towards having a person at administration who coordinates, who looks at the impacts of what's going on and how is this going to impact the state. How is it going to impact the environment? How is it going to impact municipalities? Because living in Unalaska, I get bits and pieces of the picture. I'll see Admiral Brooks once every 6 months. I'll see Arnie Fugelvog once every 6 months and pick up pieces of what possibly is happening. And I guess my point is I want to be at the table when they're planning to see what possible impacts there are to Unalaska and to our fisheries. And my job is to make recommendations to the City Council about what projects come forward to support the infrastructure needed for commercial fishing. So thank you for allowing us to come here today, and Arnie Fugelvog will be on the phone, I guess, and he's going to start out and sort of give the perspective of what's happening in Washington, D.C. concerning policy. I think we're really lucky to have Admiral Brooks here today. He travels quite often, and just that we're all together in the same town is pretty amazing. And as well, I appreciate Dave Benton coming forward today to talk about, you know, the actual fisheries aspects and what's going on with planning with that. So if we could get Arnie on the phone.
Chris, before we do that, any questions from committee members? I'm not seeing any. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned maybe the state having more involvement, perhaps appointing a person or some kind of an entity to mm-hmm. keep a closer eye on the developing issues with the passageway. But maybe expand on that for a moment. And what would you see in terms of like helping a coastal community like Unalaska from the state's point?
Well, it would help in that you'd have a person to contact. And like now, I'll call John Katz's office and get some information, or I'll call Arnie. But a person who's actually looking at these things to go, here's some impacts of what's going to happen, and who's working on them. Mm-hmm. Who's the point of contacts at DEC or the Corps of Engineers or whoever for some of these coastal communities that are going to be impacted?
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, as long as we have you here, I would like to hear your overview of the Ocean and Seas Treaty, where we're at on that. And as a resident of the state, I think that it's incumbent on all of us to keep apprised of what's going on with that. So I would like to hear what you have to say about that.
I think Arnie is going to be talking about that. Mr. Fugel.
Yeah, I'm here, Chris.
Okay.
I would appreciate if you guys don't mind if I could go first. I've got I got meetings in a half an hour coming in.
Okay, Arnie. Well, great to have you online. And if you would, identify yourself. And
sure. Thanks, Bryce. This is Arnie Fugelvog. I'm a legislative assistant for Senator Lisa Murkowski. I do fisheries, transportation, natural resource issues, including the Arctic. And I've been spending a lot of time the last couple of years working on Arctic issues. Today, I'd just like to give you a brief overview of how much is going on at a federal level. And then hopefully this will stimulate some conversation. Ultimately, what I would like to pose to the committee would be to put some thought into how Alaska can get involved in the dialogue, how the legislature can get involved, how the state can get involved through the agencies, and of course how the communities and the residents can get involved. So I think that's something that we need to have future conversation about. But right now I'm just going to give you a very brief overview touching on a number of issues, and I appreciate also that Admiral Brooks and Dave Benton are both there, so I won't go into the Coast Guard role or focus too much on the fisheries, because they're there to provide that input. Anyway, Senator Murkowski has become very involved on Capitol Hill, obviously, as one of the two senators from Alaska. I would say the most involved in Arctic issues. Partially that was due to her position on foreign relations, but a lot of it was just because of her interest in the issue. Now as ranking member on Energy Committee, of course, she has a large role to play in the development on the North Slope and the Chukchi and North Aleutian Basin as well. And I have just continued to get more and more involved in the issue. So she has done numerous speeches on Arctic, whether it's speaking in front of the Council on Foreign Relations, on shipping issues, at the National Defense College. She's traveled quite extensively to give speeches, and many times has followed Admiral Brooks in presenting various ideas about what's happening in the Arctic and priorities for moving forward. I would say the first priority that the Senator has and the U.S. Senate has on Arctic right now would be to ratify the United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea Treaty. And I won't spend much time going into it. I think that there might be a resolution going around the House very soon about supporting ratification. That's a longer conversation. I will just say that I am part of a work group on behalf of the senator that involves some fairly high-level members of former ambassadors, John Negroponte, Dick Armitage, Leon Panetta. We're all part of this work group trying to strategize and figure out how we can get the treaty ratified by the Senate. It's our goal to do that this year in this Congress, and we're working pretty actively with weekly meetings try to figure out how to do that. I would say that I think the chances are good, but it's going to be it's still going to be a real battle. It takes 8 days of floor time, and that's the biggest hurdle right now. So scheduling is a big challenge, and we're thinking probably summertime before the August recess, but that hasn't been worked out yet. I guess the other major issue that I worked on for the senator was the development of the new U.S. Arctic policy, and I can certainly provide that to the committee so they can kind of look at what the new document is to guide the U.S. policy. That policy was developed by the last administration over about a two-year time period. We were the only member of the Hill that provided input. The senator provided priorities, and I was available to testify in front of the work group. It was headed up by State Department and National Security Council, and it involved pretty much all the federal agencies in the development of a new policy. Without going into it in too much detail, again, I'll provide it to the committee for you guys to review. It hits on a number of policy areas in the Arctic. The last policy was in 1994. It recognizes the changes, primarily driven by impacts of climate change, and it lays out priorities and objectives and a path forward. Right now, we're at the stage where we're meeting with State Department to figure out implementation strategy. And I will say that the senator had a very productive meeting with Secretary Clinton, pre-confirmation meeting where she brought up Arctic. We had a number of questions at her confirmation hearing at the Foreign Relations Committee. And we have a follow-up meeting with Secretary Clinton in April where she'll come back in and she'll sit down with the senator. And we're just going to talk about Arctic issues. A big part of that will be is how to implement the policy, what Alaska's priorities are and what we expect out of this administration. So let me move down my list. There's a number of federal initiatives that we're trying to support. Admiral Brooks will go into Arctic Domain Awareness and the Coast Guard's plans. We're very supportive of what the Coast Guard would like to do in the Arctic. Yesterday we had a meeting with the Ambassador of Canada. We talked extensively about Arctic cooperation. Canada has come out with a new statement basically reiterating what their Arctic policy is. For the most part, with the exceptions of some disagreements on the sovereignty of the Northwest Passage, and we don't quite have a resolution yet on our maritime boundary in the Beaufort, Canada wants to work hand-in-hand with the United States, and I know Admiral Brooks has had a great working relationship with the Canadian Coast Guard. We would like to see that partnership continue, and we offered our office as a resource for the Canadians to both work with the state of Alaska and any of the federal agencies. So we have contact and meetings periodically with all the Arctic nations that I can get to come in. I meet periodically with Iceland, Norway, Denmark, Greenland. The Russians are a little bit harder. They did participate in the Arctic Parliamentarian meeting, and we had some good discussions. But as anyone who's there, who's worked with them, can tell you, that's a bigger challenge. So, moving along, the Arctic Fisheries Treaty. Senator Stevens, Senator Murkowski got a Senate Resolution 17 passed through the U.S. Congress Joint Resolution, which directed the United States to initiate international discussions and take necessary steps with other nations to negotiate an agreement for managing migratory and transboundary fish stocks in the Arctic Ocean. One of the primary motivators behind this was the action by the North Pacific Council to develop an Arctic FMP, and basically to put a moratorium on fishing north of the Bering Sea until we have stock assessments and a better handle on not only what the resource is, but what type of fisheries that the council would allow. That proactive action, which Dave Benton was a big part of by the North Pacific Council, has been heralded basically both internationally and domestically by pretty much everybody as a really positive step for the Arctic, and I've been very proud to support that and share that with people in the context of a potential Arctic fisheries treaty. I know the State Department has taken the Council's Arctic FMP with them overseas and has presented it to some of the other Arctic nations. This is going to be a real challenge, as you can imagine, trying to get all the Arctic nations to agree. But it's a worthwhile effort, and we're working hand in hand with the State Department on that and I will be able to kind of keep you guys updated as we move forward. I anticipate that to be a multi-year process to get some kind of agreements, but we're certainly off to a good start. Next is probably various agencies, what they're doing both in Alaska on the federal and state level. I think many of you are aware that the Army Corps of Engineers is trying to undertake an effort called the Regional Ports and Harbors Study, where they would do a study of all the regions in Alaska, looking at what the ports and harbor needs are, both including infrastructure and ports of refuge. I think this is going to be very important as we look at increased shipping through the Arctic, through the Bering Straits, to see what kind of resources we have and we need. So we've been supportive of that effort and have tried to authorize and help appropriate funds to pay for that study. I think that's going to be a crucial piece of whatever comprehensive look we take at all the activities in the Arctic, and the Army Corps is very active and very interested in playing a role. I'll let Admiral Brooks kind of hit on the Coast Guard's activity in the Arctic. Again, we're supportive of their efforts, including the possibility of doing a waterways assessment. We know that we're headed down the road toward an Aleutian Island risk assessment that has been scoped and I think designed and is probably underway now. I think, from my opinion, that we need a waterways assessment and possible risk assessment, both in the Chukchi and Bering Sea as we or Bering Strait as we move forward. We'll have to figure out how that works timing wise with the others. Traffic separation scheme possibly for the Bering Straits. Again, Admiral Brooks may touch on that, but that's something that we support through the IMO, and I think since it's a fairly extensive process to get that developed, that the sooner the better, and we're ready to stand by and assist in that process as well. There's a number of other things that we need to have occur before we have more activity in the Arctic. Vessel tracking, AIS, aids in navigation. There's conversations with MARAD, Coast Guard, Army Corps, kind of all the players about all of that. But I think all those are going to be important, and we're going to need to put resources toward all those things. On a governance level, Senator Murkowski was the U.S. representative on the Arctic Parliamentarians. The United States also sits on the Arctic Council with a representative of the State Department. We want to continue both those forums. We're not sure yet if the senator is going to be able to participate in Arctic Parliamentarians since she got off of the Foreign Relations Committee when she got her seat on Appropriations, but we're working through that process now. One of the things I would be happy to report on is that there's a new ship headed for the Arctic. We'll talk about icebreakers in a minute, but there's a new ship headed for the Arctic. It's going to be a National Science Foundation ship to replace the Alpha Helix that has been in Seward. In the stimulus bill, there's approximately $150 million for the construction of this ship. It's called the ARRV, the Alaska Regional Research Vessel. We're hoping that it will be homeported in Seward as the Alpha Helix was. It will be run by the University of Alaska and paid for by NSF. The ship will be a great scientific platform. It is not a heavy icebreaker. It is it's light. I would say it's even lighter than the Healy, but it will be able to go through some ice to do scientific research. It also, in the last design I saw, will have capability to do fisheries survey. I don't know about full bottom trawling, but certainly to do some fisheries research as well. So it'll be a multi-use vessel. I think it'll be a great addition to the Alaska fleet, and give us a lot more capability to do research in the Gulf, Bering Sea, and further north. So that ship will probably take 3 years to be built, but hopefully we'll be seeing that in Seward in the near future. As I move down, the Foreign Relations Committee is going to have a hearing on the Arctic. It was slated for later this month, but due to many confirmations that the Foreign Relations Committee has to participate in, that Arctic hearing is going to be postponed probably till early May. But I guess the point of that is just the Foreign Relations Committee, from my recollection, from my research, hasn't had an Arctic hearing before. So I think that, again, shows that there is strong interest in the Arctic. I think that Senator Murkowski has got it sufficiently on the radar screen of Senator Clinton. Of Secretary Clinton. Senator Kerry has been very supportive and very cooperative, and it was their idea to have a hearing on the Arctic. So we're looking forward to that. I think a number of Alaskans will be participating in that, and I think that it's going to continue to bring more attention on what's happening in the Arctic and the needs, and help us develop a path forward. So I'm welcome to answer questions right now, and again, I'll have a couple comments at the end, but that's a brief overview. There's lots happening back here on Arctic issues. All the agencies that were involved in development of the Arctic policy are going to be going through and kind of reaffirming their work. We don't anticipate the policy is going to be changed much, but the new administration does have the ability to go into the policy, and if they want to pull it back and rewrite it, they can. The thing about the Arctic policy is that it's not a partisan policy at all. It's not political. It is written and intended to last through a decade or more. The last one lasted 14 years. So we anticipate the policy is broad enough and comprehensive enough and allows enough work underneath the broad policy goals that it outlines to pretty much cover everything. If more environmental protection is necessary, then it certainly allows that within the policy for the agencies to implement more than what the policy generally covers. So I guess I'll just open it up for questions now.
Thank you very much, Arnie. That was an excellent overview. And what do you have time-wise? Are we looking at 5-10 minutes maybe?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm good. I've got 20 minutes till my next meeting, and so whatever, we can go right up until that as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Any questions, committee members? I guess I had one question, Arnie, and that is in terms of Chris's reference to maybe ideally having a centralized point of contact within the state. Is that an issue from your standpoint? I guess recognizing that this whole issue of opening up the passageway is still developing, it's very much ongoing. Any comments?
Yeah, well, I guess, and Chris hit it really well. For us, I mean, certainly I can give this rundown to anybody I talk to and explain to them what we're doing in the Arctic. But then when other people ask me, well, what is Alaska doing, it's very difficult for me to provide a whole lot. Now, the Larry Hardig and others who are in agencies are very involved in particular work groups on coastal erosion. Obviously, the climate change subcommittee and others have been, I think, involved in many areas that touch in the Arctic. What I would encourage you guys to explore and the members of the public that are there to explore, is there a better way? Is there, as Chris mentioned, one point of contact that might be best to lead this effort? It would certainly be handy for us. I worked through John Katz through the governor's office here in D.C. hand in hand daily on most issues, and they've been very involved. It was Katz's office that got Governor Palin to endorse ratification of the law of the sea. As we've been working through Arctic issues, I asked them if they could do that, and they did. She also got the National Governors Association to endorse it, so that has been really important, and that will be very important as we move forward here in the Senate. So we do have that relationship. I guess the biggest issue is that most of us back here are so busy that it's difficult to take the time to run through it. Also difficult to kind of figure out who in the state is going to coordinate. There are working groups that there's a lot of overlap. I mentioned a couple. I think it would be important for the legislature and the state, the agencies, and the communities to kind of figure out how they might want to move forward, and whether that's a working group or some kind of initiative, or asking the governor to designate one particular agency, one office within an agency, or even within her own office. I think that would be those are really good discussions. I would I would say that there's so much going on in the Arctic, both through the International Polar Year and all the scientific research. Alaska is very involved there. Obviously, we have multiple federal agencies in Alaska that are very involved, and many state agencies that are very involved. The general public, with the exception maybe of the residents, say North Slope Borough and others, are not as involved or not as up to speed on what is happening, and that's where I think I see a big challenge is how to get that information out and how to take input back into the process. So I don't have a solution off the top of my head, but I would really like to see that conversation happen in Alaska. It would be very useful for me to know I have a contact on Arctic that I could call and say, hey, we just met with the Arctic Council, and they want to come to Alaska a certain date and do some community meetings, or I'm meeting with Marriott and they want to talk about how they want to develop AIS and vessel tracking in the Arctic, and I generally know who the different players are to be involved, but I don't have a point of contact. And it's very time consuming for us to try to kind of get a hold of everybody. So and as well within Alaska, I think having either a work group or someone in the governor's office administration, maybe even within the legislature, to kind of put something together, because the Arctic as an issue is being raised to a much higher priority here in the federal government. I think we're going to see a lot more attention and focus. We're going to see more research headed that way. You're going to see more more involvement by the federal government, and I want to make sure that the state is just as involved as the feds are up in Alaska.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fugelvog, this is Representative Bob Book. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm phenomenal. The first time I heard about your regional ports and harbor studies was years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And it was in a Coast Guard overview. And he was, the commander at that time was speaking in terms of being put in charge because of the Homeland Security Act. Could you talk about the overview that the Coast Guard's going to have in the future?
Well, the regional ports and harbors project I'm talking about is the Army Corps of Engineers. With Admiral Brooks there, I think he'd be able to answer any questions about their role. Obviously, they have a crucial role, and I think they're going to be right at the table in the development of anything we do. But what we're looking at is the Army Corps, who's in charge of the harbors in Alaska, both construction and operation and maintenance of the harbors. They see multiple needs for it, and the first thing we need is that we have we need a lot more dollars to come to Alaska ports, Alaska harbors. So the study has a couple of important goals. One is that we can argue how important Alaska ports and harbors are in a national context, and climate change impacts in the Arctic are going to help us do that better. Because right now our ports and harbors compete on a national level with all the others, and we don't fare very well in benefit cost analysis, which are weighted toward ports which are delivering thousands and thousands of containers across their docks every day. So from a standpoint of getting construction and O&M, the dredging of ports and harbors in Alaska, that's one piece of it. The other part is just to take a full assessment of what Alaska's needs are and to incorporate all the changes that are coming with the loss of sea ice and increased shipping and tourism, oil and gas development, all these things. And the Corps needs to be at the table because they're the ones who are going to be doing the construction, the designation of ports of refuge. If we're going to have ships in a decade running down through the Bering Strait, maybe we're going to have ice strength and nickel freighters from Siberia coming down through the straits. I think it's important for us to take a real comprehensive look at what kind of infrastructure do we have along the coast, which I think everybody knows is very little. What are our needs? What are our timelines? And how do we go about dealing with the potential activity increases? So I think it's good to start now. It takes a long time to develop these studies. It's going to take a lot of money to do a regional port and harbor study virtually of every region in the state of Alaska. And that's kind of the role and what we're dealing with right now. I can't really speak to the Coast Guard's role on that specifically.
Follow, Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're addressing exactly what was brought up years ago, so I was just wondering where we're at on those studies.
Well, we've gotten funding the last couple of years to kind of the initial funding on it. It came to, well, I've only been in the office 2 years. It came to me 2 years ago, and they hadn't really made any headway. And so Senator Murkowski supports this concept and sees the utility behind it. And so she's gotten appropriations the last couple of years. Specifically, though, it's going to take a lot more, and that's what we need to work on next, is getting more money. The preliminary study about what regions, what it would take to do the study, unfortunately, you almost have to do a study to design a study. That's just the process that we go through. So we're still in the preliminary stages, and then we need to go out and get larger appropriations so we can actually get on the ground to determine, to get started itself on the bigger picture study. So we're probably a year or two away from really kicking off, but it's a high priority and it's something we really need.
Hope
that helped.
Final follow-up, Representative Book.
Yes, thank you. So how much money was appropriated to begin with?
It's only been a few million dollars, a couple, I think, and that's sounds like a lot of money, but it isn't, not for a study of this size. And the Corps tells me they probably need between 5 and 10, and so we need to start working on the larger appropriations now. That's where we're at now. We got another, I think, $500,000 in the FY09 omnibus, and that should get them through this year, and then now we're ready to go out and get some larger dollars. That's what we need.
Final commentary.
Mr. Book. Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you send us information on what has been done with that few million dollars to date, please?
You bet.
Thank you.
Questions, other committee members? If not, Chris, did you want to offer any observations while we have Arnie on the line here for the next few minutes?
No, I know he's busy. Appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today, Arnie.
You bet, Chris. Thanks for the invitation.
Okay. Well, Arnie, if you could stay online as long as you possibly can, we'll call the Admiral up next and begin his presentation. And whenever you're ready to go, we'll just expect you to sign off, and we also very much appreciate you.
You bet. And Mr. Chairman, if you could, any information you need that you could distribute to the committee members, I'm going to get an update of the Regional Ports and Harbors Project. I'm going to send you the U.S. Arctic Policy. Anything else that you guys talk about after I'm off that you want, let me know, and I will get you the information.
Thank you, Arnie, for offering that. With that, let's next go to Admiral Brooks, who'll be giving a PowerPoint presentation. Admiral, if you wouldn't mind giving your name and affiliation with the record, please, and then begin your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Admiral Gene Brooks. It's Arthur Eugene. That's where the Arthur comes from. And I'm the 17th Coast Guard District Commander, which means I'm responsible for Coast Guard operations in Alaska. And I'm happy to be here today to talk about a couple of my favorite subjects, meaning Unalaska, but also the Arctic. And I'm going to, some of this is for a general audience, so I'm going to go pretty quickly here through the major issues that we see in the Arctic, and please ask questions or we can catch back up later. When I started getting into the Arctic a couple of years ago, my initial indications were that this was an issue for 30 years from now. This was something that we needed to start working on and start laying bricks in somebody else's wall. And in the first year of looking at this, I realized this is not 30 years from now. This is here now. This is upon us now. Visiting with the people of the North, they again and again ratified that these issues were real and that they'd been telling us about them for the last 10 years at least, and why weren't we listening? The big issue, of course, is the retreat of the multi-year polar sea ice, which opens up the Arctic for shipping more of the time. September 2007 was the smallest that the multi-year polar pack has been in recorded history, and that has a number of effects. Challenges, though, is when the wobbly planet tilts away from the sun, as it is right now, the pole refreezes. And we've had sea ice below the Pribilofs in the Bering Sea this year. Right now, the southern wind has pushed the sea ice above the Pribilofs. But we still have this dynamic of frozen, breaking up, refreezing. It's a very hazardous, difficult environment. Why does the sea ice matter? Well, if the top of the world is wet and oceanic, then the ships of the world can come across the top. In fact, this year, for the first time in history, both the northern sea route across the top of Russia and the Northwest Passage through Canada were open simultaneously. We've had one or the other open at different times in history, but they were both open this year on the 21st of August. And for almost 5 weeks, ships could transit, non-icebreaking ships, across the top of the world. The numbers of ships that are doing this are still relatively small, but it's growing. There's a comprehensive study coming out of the Arctic Research Commission in April to analyze Arctic shipping. The bulk of Arctic shipping is currently on the European side. There are a lot of traffic, year-round traffic, from Murmansk into northern Europe, bringing oil and ore and other commercial vessels on ice-breaking tankers, and they're actually designing ice-breaking container ships to operate primarily in Europe right now. The other news for us is that the ships, why would a ship do this? Well, if you're dealing with transits from Asia to Europe or Europe to Asia and you're using the Panama or Suez canals, going over the top is half the distance. The commercial ships are not doing this yet because it's still a very hazardous transit. Lloyd's of London will not insure it because you can encounter ice at any point. And they live on set schedules and set delivery times, and the Arctic is still too uncertain. For now, it's still too uncertain. But when they do come over the top, the new choke point of the planet becomes the Bering Strait. Everything coming and going will have to go through this passage. Yes, sir.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Admiral. Could you go back one slide and point out what the boxes on the lower right are all about?
The boxes are the choke points in the transit. The Northwest Passage through Canada, there's actually four or five different routes among the islands to get through there. But those are the straits where ice and vessel traffic are the most concern. This is where ships will be in close contact with each other in ice. There's one spot on the north coast, and I forget the name of the island in Russia that they have to transit by. But the boxes are the places where we're most concerned about traffic in close proximity.
Thank you, sir.
While we have a pause here, let me just have the record reflect that Representative Munoz has been here for some time, and we'd like to welcome Representative Johnson to the table. Thank you.
Yes, sir. It would take 7 to 10 years to get an approved vessel traffic system through the International Maritime Organization. The challenge of the Bering Strait is that it's a well-known international strait. Its status is understood internationally. It's half Russian, half American, so whatever we do, we'll have to do jointly with the Russians. I've talked with the Russians at my level. The Russians see this as an issue that's coming. It's just a matter of deciding what type. Right now, we don't need a traffic management scheme, but we're assuming in 7 to 10 years we will, trying to get ahead of this to make sure that the problem here is the Selendang IU problem, ships running aground, ships breaking down and drifting ashore, ships colliding with each other, the things that large ships can do if you don't pay attention. And any of these ships could cause a large oil spill, just propulsion fuel, not nearly a tanker, a large oil spill at Prince of Wales that would have significant environmental impact on Western Alaska. And that's why we need to avoid that from happening. You're very familiar with the options for development in the north. Some estimates say there's as much as 25% of the world's remaining hydrocarbons are in the Arctic, as many as $33 trillion in value inside 200 nautical miles, inside the exclusive economic zones of the nations of the world. And of course, the Chukchi Sea bids show you where the beef is at. So there's going to be pressure for development. You're probably familiar with the Red Dog Mine. When I first got to this job, my staff said, you need to go see this lead zinc mine up in 70 miles inland in the DeLong Mountains. And I said, why? Well, because it's the world's richest zinc mine. Again, tell me, I don't really care about zinc and mining. And they said, well, they got this really unusual port. Okay, now I missed it. What do you mean unusual port? The challenge of the North is it's very shallow, and there are no ports. And they work year-round to fill these large barns in the top left with lead and zinc. And then in 2 months in the summer, the world's largest ore ships, 80,000 tons, come into Kevalina. They anchor 11 miles offshore because it's too shallow to actually get up to the pier. And they have these special covered barges they bring up from Seattle every year that they barge the ore out, load the ore carriers offshore, and go. The reason I always highlight the Red Dog Mine is because northern Alaska is very rich in minerals, and this methodology could be used in 30 places to mine year-round and then extract seasonally based on when it opens. You can see in March last year, the sea line is right near, you can see where the ice starts and the shore begins. There's a line where just the tip of the pier sticks in the water. The tourist ships are coming. We had 7 last year coming in northern Alaska, booming business down in Antarctica. The Explorer, a little over a year ago, went down to see the ice and the penguins, and the ice ate them. The Explorer was actually booking people, passengers, to come to Alaska this past summer, summer 2008, but they didn't make it. The Bremen does make an annual trip from Europe. The German cruise ship comes to Barrow. We see more and more business with these pocket cruise ships coming into the North. The challenge right now is there was no loss of life on the Explorer because there was another ship right nearby that was able to pick everyone up. But as you can tell, when a ship's sinking at this angle, the life rafts on the submerged side are underwater. The life rafts on the other side are hanging in the air. You're not going to launch a lifeboat or a raft under those conditions. The exposure suits are all too large and don't really fit. And it's a real challenge to keep these things safe. There have been 2 other ships have grounded in Antarctica since the Explorer sank. We have not had a casualty yet in the American Arctic, but I'm not prepared for the Titanic of the North, as I call it. A lot of evidence that the species are moving north. The lower 2 left pictures are groundfish, primarily pollock, not pollock, but the pollock and the other groundfish are moving north. The first one, the farthest left, is 2003, primary catches along the Alaskan Peninsula. And by 2006, primary catch has moved north to the maritime boundary line and into the Pribilofs. And we're seeing more and more northern maritime boundary line approaching St. Lawrence Island for commercial fishing late in the season. The state scientist in Kotzebue tells me that all the species they're seeing, red king crab and tanner crab in Kotzebue Sound, salmon are decreasing, salinity's changing. All these things point to the impact of climate change and animals adapting to climate change. And Arnie talked about the Fisheries Council and their fisheries management plan that they're working for the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea and the Arctic. The challenge for me and the challenge for NOAA enforcement is once that goes into regulations, I now have got a responsibility to ensure that, in fact, no one commercially fishes in the Arctic. The species, of course, there are many, and there's been a lot of press coverage on the effects of climate change on the animals, but of course it is affecting them. This was a huge part for me going forward, is what Americans do we serve in northern and western Alaska? And primarily these are Native Alaskans who've been there for 10 to 12,000 years at least. And working with them at the tribal level, at the community level, at the borough level, at the corporate level has been one of the things we have focused on doing, because my philosophy going forward for the Coast Guard has been we will do no harm to these people, because if by going up there we harm them or their subsistence way of life, we've not really accomplished anything for Alaska. So we've done a lot. Yes, sir.
Representative Booth.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Could you go back a slide and explain EO 13-175, please?
Executive Order 13-175 is a requirement by the President. It goes back to the Eisenhower era for a federal agency to consult with Native tribes before taking any actions that materially affect their interest or well-being. The threshold for consultation has been developed through practice under the executive order. But most anything a federal agency does, a new initiative or initiative that materially changes that affects a tribe, you're required to give them notice that you're doing something or considering doing something, and then you have to give them the opportunity to consult with you about what you're planning on doing. That's the bare minimum requirement is the executive order. Our philosophy has been that it's, yes, the tribes merit consultation under the executive order, but it's tribes, it's communities, it's boroughs, it's cities, it's corporations under ANSCA. So we are doing consultation, but also engagement is a term I'm using for the broader outreach to all the manifestations of the people of the North.
Thank you, sir.
A lot of dialogue and a lot of learning. My challenge was when my first trip to Barrow, they said, Jesus, nice the Coast Guard's here, but why are you here? And what are we doing wrong? And of course, my bottom line was, you're not doing anything wrong. You're fine for what you have. The problem you have is that the world of Southern Alaska, my world of big ships, is headed your way. And I have to prepare to help you deal with that when they come. And so, but I don't know how to do that, especially in your environment. So a lot of it has been us learning, how could we operate? How could we do the things we do in Southern Alaska in a way that makes sense in Northern and Western Alaska? You know all about this. The point I like to make about infrastructure for ships is the last full-service port for a ship heading north through the Bering Strait is actually Dutch Harbor in Alaska. And you're familiar with how hard it is to get things to Dutch Harbor, but the reality is that's the last place where a large ship can come and work. Nome has some infrastructure. The Corps of Engineers has done some harbor work there. Pier building, they have a marina now. They've got infrastructure in Nome, but the large ships can't get into Nome right now. And beyond Nome, there is no place for a ship. There's no pier, there's no port, there's no nothing. So a ship that has a problem above Dutch Harbor is going to be a challenge for all of us. And I point out the importance of Dutch Harbor because as ships funnel to the Bering Strait or out of the Bering Strait, their options for supply or support, resupply for maintenance and repairs are very, very limited. And I think that's the reason why right now Dutch Harbor is so important, because if they have a problem in the Unimak Pass today, this is where they go. And of course, this is the place where they'll go in the future, I think, given the lack of infrastructure in other places. The bottom line for me was I had to prepare to do everything in Northern Alaska seasonally that we currently do in Southern Alaska. And of course, this is a picture of the Healy. Our first summer, last summer, the first thing we started doing was what we called Arctic Domain Awareness. We started flying C-130s from Kodiak into the Arctic every 2 weeks because I had no idea who was up there and what they were doing. A lot of what I do every day is I look for and track ships in the Gulf of Alaska, Southeast, the Bering Sea, the North Pacific, just to see who's out there for search and rescue, for oil spills, for homeland security, for fisheries enforcement, for all the things that I do. But I have no capability or had no capability to do that in the Chukchi Sea and in the Arctic. So we started out with Mark 1 Mod 0 eyeballs looking out the windows. We decided to do tailored force packages. We took the H-65 helicopters from Kodiak and actually one from San Francisco, and the small boats from Valdez and one from Ketchikan, and we put boats and helicopter packages into Barrow and Prudhoe Bay just to see how it would work to do what we do in Sitka or Homer now. We're just going to do them up north. Real challenging. It turned out that the helicopters were too small. Those helicopters have about 100, 120 mile range, and the distances of the north are just too great for that. And the boats, our response boats, smalls, these 25-foot boats, were way too big. These are beach operations. You're launching a heavy boat with a heavy trailer on sand, and it was tough, really tough. We also found that in August you can have summer storms in Barrow. If the wind blows from the north, the sea ice in an ice-free portion comes down and jams the beach, and you can't launch a boat at all. That was really hard. We found that because of the problems we had with the boats and the helicopters, we sent the Hamilton in the middle, one of our high endurance cutters, a ship we would normally use in the Bering Sea. We pushed them through to see how a big ship would work. Really difficult because of the sea ice, and this ship's not designed to take ice at all. It's designed for speed and has a thin hull. It's not built for ice. But we got them up there. They worked great once they got up there because the ship movement compensates for the helo range, and the ship can always find a clear spot to drop a boat. But it's hard for them because of the lack of infrastructure to support them. The Healy was back up north working for the National Science Foundation last summer, did substantial work with the Sir Wilfrid Laurier, the Canadian breaker. One of the key aspects for me was we brought Canadians with us in all our patrols. In fact, the Canadian Coast Guard loaned me one of their very experienced commanders, Commander Grandmeier, had made 11 Arctic patrols on their breakers to come north with us and help us. And we traded people with most of our Canadian ships. Boating safety, our Coast Guard auxiliarists, the volunteers that help us down south teach boating safety classes, went north and taught boating safety in the villages up north. That was a very popular program. And we sent the buoy tenders, spar and hickory, from Kodiak and Homer up to do waterways analysis. Where do we need to put buoys or lights or beacons or other things to support future shipping in the Arctic? Things we learned. The infrastructure is almost completely insufficient. 37 people in Barrow fill both hotels and the Air Force contractor berthing at the radar site. That's how hard it was to fit into Barrow. No hangars for the helos. Communications, there are some local VHF comms, but for the most part, ranging across the north, there are no comms. I talked about the helos and the boats and the lack of, you really need ice-hardened vessels. We really relied on indigenous people to make any of this work. This summer, this year, we're trying to work a spring patrol for the polar sea into the Bering Sea to get some ice-breaking training and perhaps to make a port call in Russia. One of the things I'm working very hard is to join the Russians. General Putov in Khabarovsk has said that the Russians are going to come forward and rebuild the border patrol station in Big Diomede, and they're going to defend the Russian border in the Arctic. And I hope to join them and work together with them to keep this thing cooperative and supportive rather than competitive. We're going to resume the Arctic Domain Awareness flights in late this month or early in April, whenever the ice starts to break up. We are looking at different deployments, larger helicopters, smaller boats, focused on Nome and Barrow this summer, and we'll see how that goes, and we'll continue the waterways analysis and the outreach in the Arctic. Just a quick point, if you will indulge me. Early in this, a reporter asked me, what's the Coast Guard's biggest challenge in the Arctic? And I said, well, they were expecting to hear, you need another icebreaker. And I said, well, the biggest challenge I have is that when Joe Citizen sits down at night in Des Moines, Iowa, and cracks a beer to watch the ball game, it never crosses his mind that he's a member of an Arctic nation. But because of Alaska, the United States is an Arctic nation. And a smart lawyer in Colorado Springs said, okay, you're going on and on about this Arctic nation stuff. What does it mean to be the member of an Arctic nation? And I said, well, it means that you own land and water and submerged land in the Arctic. And it means you have the opportunity to develop some really spectacular resources in the Arctic. But it also means that you have an obligation to an indigenous people who've been there for 10 to 12,000 years to help them maintain their culture and their subsistence way of life. And you have a responsibility to maintain a pristine Arctic environment that's being stressed by climate change. The conundrum is we don't have a way to make this balance. We don't have a way for the coastal villages' voices to be heard, for the state of Alaska to be heard, for the United States to decide what the American position is going to be with regard to this balance. How are these decisions made? And oh, by the way, this is the same issue that all the Arctic nations have. Every Arctic nation, Russia, Greenland, they all have this issue. And in fact, the Arctic is an international issue. The Chinese, the Japanese all had research ships in the Arctic trying to disprove the submerged land claims that Arctic nations will make under the Law of the Sea Convention, because it's in their interest for the Arctic to stay as open as possible for their development. So this is a tough conundrum. The new Arctic policy signed out in the midnight hours of the Bush administration is currently being reviewed by the Obama administration. The thing I like about this is it's gone from a science-centric policy under President Clinton, and science is more important than ever. Believe me, we need to do more science than ever because we need to determine what's happening to the planet, and the Arctic is a bellwether for that. But this adds the full spectrum of human issues, from homeland security to environmental preservation, to resource management, to Arctic Nation cooperation, to indigenous community interest, science, all those things. But again, I really can't say much about this because I think we need to let the Obama administration take a look at whether this is the way they feel about the Arctic. And that's quick run through. What questions do you have for me, sir?
Thank you, Admiral. Any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson, did you have your hand up? Any prospects in the stimulus package for funding that would lend itself to this overall effort?
Personal opinion. I was amazed that they removed the icebreakers from the stimulus package as pork. That showed to me in graphic terms the American ignorance of the Arctic. Because of the nature of this part of the world, because it freezes every year and it breaks up every year, it takes ice-strengthened vessels and ice-breaking vessels to operate in this environment. And it really is just they clearly do not understand what the Arctic means or what the Arctic is. So I don't hold that against them. I will say that the reason that I talk about the Arctic conundrum is one of the questions is how much Coast Guard. And keep in mind, the Coast Guard is really a small slice of the issues of the Arctic. You know, every federal agency, every state agency has got requirements, building requirements in an opening Arctic. And the question for the state is how much state do you want? Because you're already there. Your agency is already working in this environment. But how much more do you want? How will you adapt or react to climate change? From the federal level, every other federal agency has got equivalent responsibilities. I'm there because it's largely a maritime domain and the ships are coming. But everybody's got the same issues. And the question for the United States is how much FBI do you want? How much Department of Interior do you want? How much do you want in the Arctic? And I don't know the answers to that. I don't even know how much Coast Guard they want. I tell people that the issues of the Arctic, I'm not the one who decides whether a port is built, but I think in response to your question, sir, the Coast Guard, once the Army Corps or someone decides to build a port, the question will be, well, what level of security do we need for that port, and how does it fit in the regime of the Maritime Transportation Security Act? I don't know the answer to those questions. I don't decide where a port's going to be. I just deal with it once it exists. I don't decide whether anybody's going to drill an oil well, but I have to provide maritime safety and security to the decisions of others when they decide to do things.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, a very interesting presentation. Would you describe your interactions with Canada, you know, and how that works? I mean, are we working with them? Is there similar concerns, collaborating or whatever? You
know? We're working very well with them. I have a very strong relationship with Admiral Pyle and the Maritime Forces Pacific, the Canadian Navy in Victoria. A very strong relationship with the Canadian Coast Guard in Vancouver for the West, Ms. Vija Porax. Also worked very closely with General Miller, who is the commander of Canada's Joint Task Force North in Yellowknife. Joint Task Force North is the Canadian military component that does surveillance in the Canadian Arctic and does security in the Canadian Arctic. And we trade intel briefs about every week throughout the year. The Canadians have given me all their data on ships transiting the Northwest Passage. I tell them who's going through the Bering Strait. We work together in all aspects, really because it's a we must. Nobody's got enough resources to deal with the Arctic, with the issues of the Arctic, with protecting animals, protecting people, all that alone. The only hope we have with current resourcing is to work together. That's why I relied so heavily on the Canadian Arctic experience, because I didn't have Coast Guard people with that kind of skill set. They did, and they were willing to loan them. We're loaning Americans to them for skill sets we have. So the conversation with the Canadians has been constant. I mean, we work with them every day in the Dixon Entrance or doing search and rescue in Prince Rupert. You know, out of Sitka, out of Ketchikan, we work a lot with the Canadians. But the northern relationship has really developed over the last couple of years. We agree to disagree over this boundary thing. You know, there's a 6,200 square mile boundary dispute in the Beaufort Sea that we just ignore because that's not my issue and it's not the Canadian Coast Guard's issue. That's a state foreign service kind of thing, and we'll let them figure that out.
Representative Book and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Admiral Brooks, in your conversations with some of our other northern countries and in speaking with the Russians, what do you know about the process that they're in right now of building 100 double-bottom ice-breaking LNG tankers?
The Russians in particular are the most experienced Arctic nation. I mean, if you look at the nations of the world, they have the most Arctic. They will run 300 supply ships a year into the Arctic just to resupply their Arctic stations and their Arctic ports. They have a couple. And the Russians have many of the same issues. You know, it's great distances, no infrastructure, indigenous people, pressure for development, pressure for transit. And so the Russians are looking at, they want to protect what's theirs, they want to identify what's theirs, they want to take care of what they view as their national interest. And it's the same issue that we have every day in the Bering Sea. My largest challenge day in and day out is manning the maritime boundary line to ensure that foreign vessels don't come into Alaskan waters and steal Alaskan fish. And I work that scene with the Russians, because I would prefer for the Russians to deal with Russians than for me to have to deal with Russians. And but it's also Chinese, Taiwanese, Japanese, Korean, you know, it's the whole thing. And so I communicate almost daily with my counterparts in Petropavlovsk, Kamchatka, working out issues with Russians. In fact, last week we actually worked a case with them where there, some people were apparently doing illegal at-sea transfers to avoid Russian fish quotas against the Russians. And I have no interest in anybody stealing Russian fish, you know, especially Americans stealing Russian fish. So the point being is that it's in our best interest to work with them, especially in the Bering Sea, the Chukchi Sea, and the Arctic. And given Alaska's history with Russia, I think it's easier for Alaska, you know, to deal with the Russians.
Mr. Chairman?
Follow up, Burton Book.
I don't see we have much choice.
Well, you don't.
So the point I'm trying to make is we have two routes. You brought them both up today in very explicit detail. Do you work with them in some of their ongoing processes now for shipping their LNG in the northern route?
Right now, they're not doing that kind of shipping in the Pacific.
In the Pacific, but in the northern
route. In the north route and into Europe, yes, sir, they're doing it. And I don't have visibility on how much or how they're doing that. My concern is that sooner or later somebody's going to look, in their case, to the east.
Right.
And the Russian ships, I assume, eventually will come. That's why I'm pushing for some sort of traffic scheme with the Russians. If I can get a deal with the Russians to control the Bering Strait and to minimize risk in the Bering Strait before the ships come, it's going to be better for everyone involved. I would hate for this to come and we're not ready. And so I'm trying to stay ahead of that.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that the Russians are going to, and I'm using the term fortify, I don't think that's your term, but are defending its borders. I guess my question is against what? And should we be doing the same thing?
The Russians, like any other country, want to protect what's theirs. And visiting with the people in Little Diomede, they routinely engage in what the Russians view as border incursions. And the Russians tend to scoop them up and bring them back. And it's a dance that occurs in the Bering Strait now. It's been occurring forever. I think a lot of my opinion, that's rhetoric. You know, because the Russians are looking at their posturing because they know that these boundaries will have to be determined, these boundaries that we currently don't know what they are. And I don't think it's belligerence on their part. I think they're just trying to identify what's theirs and protect their interest. I understand that. I'm willing to help them protect their interest as long as it supports American or Alaskan interest. So I view some of this as rhetoric, and some of this is the world as they see it.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'd mentioned that the last port was Dutch Harbor. Is that true for the Russian side as well?
Well, they have ports on the Russian side. PK, they've got a port in Anadyr. Providenia is a very small place, but Anadyr has a little something. But the further north you go on the Russian side, same problem. Very shallow, very limited infrastructure. Very difficult to get to.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might, so, and I'm looking at a commercial aspect, if this is going to become a shipping highway, would it behoove us to move a port to Nome or something where we could take advantage of filling up, you know, I hate to use a gas station, but that kind of infrastructure, would that be something that would behoove us, or are we talking about?
It's pure speculation on my part, but from a safety perspective, having a place that you could work ships would be very, very helpful. If you look at the Cougar Ace case, the large car carrier that rolled over a couple of years ago south of the Aleutians, Dutch Harbor is the only way we were able to save that ship. You know, coming into Unalaska, into Wide Bay, that was a tough decision, you know, for Unalaska to make, saying, okay, we're going to go along with this idea of bringing a ship laying on its side into our waters, posing a potential risk. But we were able to save the ship without any impacts because we were able to get it out of the weather. Right now, there's no place up north to get out of the weather if you have to work a ship like Cougar Ace or any of these other large ships that can be disabled. And there are no tugs or infrastructure. You know, my biggest challenge, my biggest concern on a regular basis is the Selandang-Ayu scenario for the Aleutian Islands. That's why the risk assessment of the Aleutians is my highest priority right now. And my next priority is going to be a similar assessment for Cook Inlet, because we have the same issue. You know, we just lost the Monarch in Cook Inlet, and the question becomes, you know, what do we need to reduce risk in the Aleutians, where we've got, you know, 400 to 500 ships a month going through the Unimak Pass now, or where do we reduce risk in Cook Inlet? And then the next step would be Western Alaska, Bering Strait, potentially then the North Slope. You know, while we have time to prepare, what measures can we take now to reduce the risk? And, oh, by the way, you know, this is not my thing, but certainly for others, what are the opportunities for development or economic growth based on ship traffic that will possibly come in the future? Again, I don't make those decisions. I just react to the decisions of others.
And one additional last question, and you may have covered this in my absence, and I apologize, but what are the repercussions of us signing onto the laws of the sea treaty, and the converse of that, what are the repercussions of us not signing onto the treaty? I mean, does it hamstring us if we don't? I mean, we still have, you know, power to exert. So what does that do for us? I mean, it's probably more friendly to sign the treaty than it is just to defend our borders. But if you'd kind of...
It's interesting. You know, this treaty was worked for a long time, and in fact, the United States was one of the primary architects of the treaty. You know, it would maybe too much to say we built the thing, but the United States is one of the primary voices in designing this. Initially not ratified because of the real issues with deep seabed mining and other features that, but the reality is that since 82, we have observed this treaty that we're not signatory to as the law of the sea. You know, and we take the benefits of it every day with 12-mile territorial seas and 200-mile exclusive economic zones. The boundaries we have, the maritime boundary line, is a product of this system. The United States is kind of taking advantage of this treaty, but we're not meeting our responsibilities. In fact, the complaints I get from Canadians and others are, because you're not signatory, you're not at the table where all these decisions are being made right now, you're out of the loop. But we need your leadership. We need American leadership in the international arena, especially when it comes time to make the very difficult decisions of where are the boundaries of the Arctic, because we don't know today where any of the boundaries of the Arctic are. We have this disagreement with Canada. We've got a boundary with Russia, but the Duma never ratified it. So if you ask lawyers in Washington, they'll say, we've got a boundary with Russia. If you ask the Russians, they say, nah, you kind of don't have a boundary with us. And, of course, the real challenge are the seabed claims beyond 200 nautical miles. If the claims that the Arctic nations could make are upheld, there's almost no international water or seafloor left in the Arctic. If they are all defeated, then there will be a lot of open water and seafloor in the Arctic where other nations like China or Australia could do development in the Arctic. All those decisions are currently being made with the United States standing outside, you know, yelling through the door. You know, we're not on the committees, we're not involved in the discussion. You know, people say that if you accede to the Law of the Sea Convention, you will abrogate sovereignty. And my position is all treaties abrogate sovereignty to some extent. You know, you give something up to get something more. And for me, yes, it's a international forum that's not necessarily friendly to the United States. Oh, well, why is that? Maybe because you haven't participated, you know, in the last 20-something years. I don't know. But I think in balance, it would be better for us to get in the game and to make our voice heard officially and responsibly at the table in all these issues, these maritime issues, but specifically the Arctic boundary issues. And we're currently not there.
With all the efforts being directed towards, you know, the opening of the Arctic, what's the Coast Guard presence going to be in Alaska in the future? Where do you see things?
Well, right now we've had a slowly growing Marine Safety Detachment in Unalaska. It's up to 12 people now, I think. Mm-hmm. That because Unalaska is our busiest port, Alaska's busiest port. I mean, Anchorage, Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, nobody comes close to Unalaska when it comes for numbers of ships, tonnage of ships, ships that come and go. Yes, most of them are taking fish, but these are ships, real ships that pose all the real ship issues. So Unalaska is a very important port for me. I don't envision substantial future Coast Guard growth in Unalaska, but it will depend on the shipping. It's like, how much Coast Guard do you need in the Arctic? Well, it really depends on how much shipping you end up with. I don't envision having 21 to 23 large cruise ships a day at Kotzebue like we have in Southeast, but you're going to have more, you know. I don't anticipate large tanker traffic through there for a long time, you know, but when it comes, you're going to have, not to the Valdez level, but you're going to have more. You know, I don't anticipate container ships until they go over the top, but eventually you're going to have more. Fishing vessels, I think our current intel estimate, and I'll let Mr. Deaton talk about fish, it'll be a while yet before there's mass pressure for large fishing fleets. But it's one of those things that being prepared ahead of time, as the council is crucial to structuring it when the day comes that you have to make decisions about Arctic fish. So every issue that we have in the South, you're going to have in the North. It's just a question of less infrastructure, less comms, less ability to deal with it. But now's the time, I think, to set the structures in place, political, economic, however, to deal with what will be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of us were wishing 5 years ago that now was the time, and some of the money that was set aside for that being in place and used now. You broached on a topic that I'm very curious about over the last couple of years in some emails. Can you go back to a top of the world map where you look at Russian boundaries? There's an island that's just north of Russia.
Wrangel Island.
Yes, sir. Could you talk briefly about some of the discussions over that island?
To be honest, I don't know the history. My understanding is that there's some sort of colorable claim by the United States to Wrangel Island based on early exploration. I don't know the details. My impression, and I only say impression because I'm speaking from ignorance here, is that in the World War II time frame, we kind of walked away from any claim to Wrangel. Though I know that Senator Helms and others have said we should assert a claim to Wrangel Island. I don't know the basis for that claim. And right now, we're not asserting any claim to Wrangel Island. But if the United States owned Wrangel Island, it would dramatically alter, you know, the seascape in the Arctic. But I'm not aware of any active claim to Wrangel Island on our part.
Follow up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to be clear before you leave here what the role of the Coast Guard is according to the Homeland Security Act. What is your priority? Who do have dominion over in all of the armed forces of the United States?
Talking about Coast Guard, basic Coast Guard jurisdiction?
Especially in this region, in this area, where we're talking about, from the information that I was given years ago, you folks have been given all of the priority. Everybody has to respond to you, and they are under your jurisdiction, more or less, is the information I got.
As a federal law enforcement agency in the law enforcement arena, I have jurisdiction over all vessels within 12 miles of the United States, regardless of nationality. I have jurisdiction over all vessels engaged in economic activities like fishing within 200 miles of the United States. I have jurisdiction over the navigable waters of the United States. This is the Army Corps of Engineers definition, which essentially means all waters in the internal part of the state that are subject to tidal influence or subject to navigation and interstate commerce. But there are places, many places in Alaska, where I have no jurisdiction. Essentially, my jurisdiction on land only extends to the back fence of a terminal or facility. I run out of jurisdiction really quickly if it's dry on the dirt. But on the water, I have federal police power on essentially all of it. But that's to enforce U.S. law, you know, Title 18, Title 46, Title 50, those kinds of things.
So, Brooke, I want to confine this discussion to the issue at hand. We have one more speaker that needs to come up. And so unless it's something absolutely pressing, I'm going to ask, maybe just ask that in the hallway afterwards. Or
sure, we can do that.
Admiral Brooks, thank you very much for your presentation and your time afterwards.
Thank you.
Mr. Benton, do you want to come forward and...
Jack, could I use this PowerPoint?
We'll leave it up there for you if that's okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Benton. I am... do you want me to turn this off or just leave it on?
You can turn it off.
Okay. Well, maybe I better not. I don't know exactly how to use it. Anyway, for the record, my name is David Benton. I'm the Executive Director of the Marine Conservation Alliance based here in Juneau. MCA is a coalition of seafood harvesters, processors, coastal communities, and support industry that participate in the groundfish and shellfish fisheries in Alaska, would probably represent 70% to 80% of that industry. And prior to working for MCA, I was the International Fisheries fella for the state of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game. I was Deputy Commissioner there and also Director for International Fisheries for many years, and worked with the Chairman in that capacity for quite a while. I haven't done that for a few years. Mr. Chairman, Admiral Brooks has hit on a lot of the kinds of issues that I wanted to talk about, but I want to highlight a few things for you, and I know the time's getting a little short, so I'll be brief. As you know, the seafood industry is very important to Alaska. We're ninth in the world in terms of production. We account for about 62% of the United States landings. It accounts for 56,000 direct, and if you add direct and indirect, that's about 78,000 jobs in Alaska. 80% of the manufacturing that's done in Alaska is seafood processing and related kinds of manufacturing activities. So it's a very big deal for Alaska, and the breadbasket for that fishery is in the Bering Sea. That's where the vast bulk of our fisheries products come from. And Dutch Harbor on Alaska has been the number one fishing port in terms of volume for the nation for many, many years because of the fisheries there. And the questions that are surfacing now about the effects of climate change, the retreat of sea ice, changing oceanographic conditions and temperature regimes are affecting the fish stocks in the Bering Sea. We're not sure exactly how. We, as Admiral Brooks showed you in one of his slides, there's evidence that fish populations are moving their center of population in a northerly manner. And when you get up into the Bering Strait and further north region, there's evidence that a number of commercially important species may be beginning their foray into new territory for them, including red and tanner crabs, raking crab and tanner crabs, even pollock and cod and salmon have been seen to be sort of maybe extending their range in an orderly manner. That's in some ways good news, in some ways not so good news. Obviously, it's evidence that climate and the changes that we're seeing are having an effect, and we don't know how those are going to affect our industry, the location of our industry, and the abundance of the resources that fuel that industry. We do know that the way to handle renewable resource management, and our fisheries are well regarded around the world as being a model for sustainable management, sustainable production. The way to do that is to have the best science you can, to listen to that science, and to be conservative in how you manage those fisheries that are harvesting those resources. We have a long record of that. North Pacific Fishery Management Council has never exceeded the recommendations of its science for harvest levels. That's 30-some-odd years, and the production that I mentioned earlier is done in a way where we have no overfish stocks of groundfish. We have some crab stocks that are in a depressed state because of climate-related or oceanographic-related problems, and we've done everything we can to try and rebuild those stocks. There's no fishing on them. A lot of habitat set aside to protect them. The reason I'm mentioning that is because, as you know, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and I want to acknowledge Ms. Stephanie Madsen in the back of the room, who was the chair of the council when we started this, it was concluded after she left the council, but she was definitely one of the leading spark plugs to make the Arctic FMP a reality. Our council has passed and has forwarded on to the Secretary of Commerce for approval a fishery management plan that would close to commercial fishing all federal waters north of Bering Strait. And that had the support of our organization and the industry generally, and it is seen, I think, around certainly around the country and around the world as one of the most proactive steps in fishery management and response to climate that has taken place to date. It's got wide acclaim around the world. Why would the fishing industry do that? Why would the fishing industry say to itself, we don't want to go up, we want to foreclose an opportunity to ourselves, and at least for some time period, instead of saying, hey, let's go up there and let's get in on the ground floor. And the reason is because the long tradition that we've had about trying to get the science right and doing things in a sustainable manner. And we recognized that the science needs to catch up with the ability to go up there and look for those resources. So the industry supported that FMP process, and we're looking forward to working with our science community and with the managers to determine what's up there, what might be available, and at some future date perhaps have fisheries occur. The other reason the industry supported the FMP is because we have had a long experience with international relations and the effects that international fisheries can have on our resources and our industry. A very good example is what happened in the Bering Sea. The United States and Russia claim 200-mile zones, and in the middle there's a pocket of international waters that we refer to commonly as the donut hole. As the Soviet Union and in Russia and the United States phased out foreign fisheries inside their zone, their respective zones, a lot of those fleets moved into this international area because there was no treaty, there were no rules, and they could go fish how they wished. And that caused problems for both the Russians and for ourselves, including incursions into our borders, and into our own waters and taking fish out of our own waters, but also overfishing in that region, which then affected stocks inside our zone. It took, and I was very deeply involved in the negotiations to get the treaty that closed the Bering Sea donut hole, and it took us the better part of 10 years to close it because of the entrenched fisheries that were going on there. Japan, Korea, China, and Poland were the ones that were left at the end of the day when we finally concluded that treaty and we closed those waters. We don't want to see a similar situation occur in the high Arctic. And we don't know, as Admiral Brooks aptly put it, we don't know where the boundaries exactly are right now. And we don't know where the resources are going to go and how they might distribute themselves. So in our judgment, it's far better if we can get a moratorium in the what probably will be the international waters of the high Arctic before fisheries occur and people have vested interests in that part of the world. So how does the United States do that? Well, the first thing that the United States has to do is walk its own talk. And so by the action of our Fishery Management Council, that gave the United States a platform to say to the rest of the world, look, we recognize there may be resources up there at some point, there may be fisheries up there at some point, but we also are taking a more measured approach, and it's going to be science-driven, and we are going to be respectful of what the wishes are of the residents of those areas and those regions. As Admiral Brooks pointed out, all the Arctic nations have indigenous people that live along those coasts and their communities that have a different way of living, and we need to be very respectful of that. So it gives the United States the platform and, if you would, the moral high ground to go to the rest of the world and say, you need to follow suit and work with us so that we can develop a regime that protects everyone's interests and, more importantly, protects the resources of the Arctic and the people that live up there. That that action by the Council and that approach has, I think, served us well so far. It's in very early stages. Arnie Fugelvog mentioned the Senate Resolution 17, which was passed by the full Congress, signed by the President. We were involved with that, and we're now involved in working with State Department on how to initiate negotiations and discussions with the rest of the world about what should happen in the Arctic. The European Union and nations on the European side are very interested in looking at fisheries exploitation in the high Arctic. That causes some concern. Spain and Portugal and some of those countries are not noted for being great stewards of the resource, and in the Atlantic side have caused some problems. We're trying to working with State Department, we're trying to get them to engage in a more consistent or a manner more consistent with the with the approach that we've taken. The Norwegians, the Icelanders, they all have interests, and so the picture up there is going to be very complicated. What we've advocated to state is to work with our Canadian counterparts and to engage with our Russian counterparts first, and to see if we can get a consensus with those two countries bilaterally, and then carry a common approach forward to those other nations that aren't necessarily part of the Arctic community but have Arctic interests or designs. The question that I've heard you ask a couple of times is how should the state of Alaska, what role can the state of Alaska play, and how should the state of Alaska engage on the issue? And my experience from years back was that Alaska can either sit back and let these events unfold around you and then be reactive, or you can, as a state, we can take control and we can take charge and be an active player. With regard to the Bering Sea and the negotiations there, working with our congressional delegation, we got statutory authority for an organization called the Bering Sea Fisheries Advisory Body, and we share U.S. seats on that body with Alaskans and Washington State fishing representatives and then scientists and managers. That organization's charged with coordinating and U.S. policy on fisheries with our Russian counterparts specifically, but has expanded its role now to a whole range of different kinds of treaties. So Alaska already has a seat at that particular table through the Department of Fish and Game, and the governor makes some appointments to that body. One of the things that Alaska had in years past, and frankly I'm not so certain that we have it any longer, we had a small group of people that were very focused on international fisheries issues. We have that still to some degree, but in thinking about the Arctic and the complexity of the issues and the pace that these issues are being dealt with, I think it would be wise for the state administration and or the legislature to consider a very focused and tight group of policy people that in their respective areas of expertise that they meet regularly. They talk about cross-cutting issues, but also are responsive both back to you and the Alaska public and the governor. I'm not going to presume to tell you how to structure that. The only thing I would urge is that it be small. You don't need 20 or 30 people because it won't work and it won't be effective. And you need to make sure that people are operating within their area of expertise. And the final piece of that is funding. And it's always a sticky wicket for these kinds of things. But one of the reasons that Alaska in the 1990s, or late 1980s and 1990s, was effective in international fisheries was that we had, and it wasn't a large pot of money, but we had travel money so we could get our officials plus interested industry folks to negotiations. It wasn't a lot of money, but it's very difficult and sometimes quite expensive to travel to Russia and to China or wherever. And it always runs into this thing about those sound like boondoggles, and we don't like boondoggles, and I can fully understand that. On the other hand, there are crucial meetings sometimes. You've got to get people to them. So that's it, Mr. Chairman, and I was going to speak more, but I think the clock behind me is catching up, so I'm done.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Excellent overview as well. And questions, committee members? Any comments? We do have just a couple more minutes before we need to conclude things, but any observations in general that you might add? We've had a really good presentation, and we've heard obviously from Kugelvog, from Senator Murkowski's office, from the Coast Guard, from Union of Alaska, but any other sort of parting comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only other thing I guess I'd add is that our congressional delegation obviously has gone through some changes, and we're fortunate in that Senator Murkowski has gotten on appropriations and in a place where she can really make an impact. Senator Begich, you know, he's on Commerce, which is a very important role for him and a very important committee for Alaska. And I would just encourage you all to think how you want to engage with the delegation. They are in a pretty darn good position. And I would include in that, how would you engage with the congressional delegation from Washington State? We have a lot of shared interests in terms of fisheries with the state of Washington, and to a lesser degree with the state of Oregon. And Senator Murray, in particular, from Washington State, is a big player now. And she's got a lot of seniority. She understands fisheries, and she understands our fisheries. And the old days of Alaska versus Washington, you know, Seattle versus Alaska or whatever, I hope and I think are well behind us. We have a lot more of common interests. We need to figure out how we can better coordinate and communicate with those folks and get our common goals achieved. That would be my other option or observation, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'm
very well taken. Thank you very much. And
committee
members, before we wrap up, which we're about to do shortly, Chris, do you want to come back up to the table and offer any last comments, given that this meeting basically was your idea?
And I appreciate the opportunity and you folks taking your time doing this, but I think my point was driven home by them that this is coming faster than anyone imagined, and 7 to 10 years really isn't that long a time frame. And for, let's say, I need to do a project to support the Admiral's mission in the Arctic, it may take 7 to 10 years to build something. So I think that this working group, or however the administration or whoever is going to do it, the Office of the Arctic, needs to be put in place. I'm not abdicating, you know, the operating budget's already passed this year, but I'm going to be working towards this for next year to get something going. Because it's the opening of a frontier. We're witnessing a new frontier opening, and we don't know what those impacts will be from increased human activity in that frontier, but we need to be ahead of the game. So I appreciate the time.
Well, thank you, everyone. And with that, the Fisheries Committee meeting will adjourn at approximately 11:50.